It's the early 1800s. On the seaside cliffs of Lyme Regis, England, a woman and her dog are perched on the rocky shore. She's covered in a heavy cloak, protecting her from the wind and the spray of the sea. She searches around for a good spot, pulls out her tools, and gets to work. Mary Anning is on the hunt for dinosaurs.
This is Carry the One
Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Hi and welcome to Carry the One Radio. I'm Arjo Ray. I'm a scientist at UCSF. And today, yes, we're talking about dinosaurs. Or more accurately, we are going to dig up a small piece of how the very first dinosaur was discovered with help from author Ian Lendler.
When the first dinosaur was announced, there were 30 people in the room. This was a very small group of weirdos. I mean, they were strange, driven people. I mean, you have to understand, most people didn't understand why these people were out in the fields, literally in fields in the rain, whacking away at rocks with hammers.
We spoke to Ian about his book, The First Dinosaur, which came out last October. It's a fun and informative read. And while it's perfect for the junior high student in your life, we scientists enjoyed it too. It's actually more than just the story of the discovery of the first dinosaur, the Megalosaurus.
It's the history of science as told through the discovery of dinosaurs.
And the history of science is the history of people and the history of ideas.
All the people involved with this was the main body of work was being done in the late 1700s and the early 1800s. And you wouldn't consider anyone nowadays a scientist. In terms of actual science, they were kind of, you know, they had flashlights in the dark and they were trying to pick their way through it. But that's what was fascinating. I mean, they were developing new areas of science.
So often, because we live in this era of technology, we take science for granted. But everything had a beginning. So did the concept of dinosaurs.
I mean, it's a weird idea. That's what I found fascinating about this whole thing, was the idea, like, look out your window wherever you are, you know, and, oh, there used to be giant, and not even giant, some were the size of chickens, giant reptiles roaming the earth. It's an insane idea. And a lot of us accept the idea of dinosaurs because we've grown up with them, but not many people could tell you, here's how we got to that idea. This is the explanation, step by step. And that's why I actually was interested in writing this book, because I didn't know how we came to the idea of dinosaurs. I wanted to explain it to myself. It all started with geology.
Here we are in the mid-1600s. The predominant source of truth in the world is religion. People believe the word of religious texts pretty much in their entirety. Even the people asking questions about the natural world use books like the Bible to guide them. And one Irish archbishop has a kind of strange idea.
That's when James Ussher measured the Bible. It was the scientific revolution. He was being a scientist of the Bible. Mm-hmm. He wanted to measure the time of the Bible. And that's really where the birth of geology started. He measured all the begats and all the things that happened, and he figured, he said, the earth started on, I think it was October 23rd or 24th, around noon, 4004 BC.
It's an estimate that some creationists still believe today. While Ussher's timeline was more than a little bit off, his idea changed people's perceptions of the past. They began turning to the Bible as a textbook of time, containing basically every important event that had happened in the past.
With that was the idea that the earth had a measurable past, right? And then once you had that idea, you could start to measure it and think about it.
The thing is, in the 1600s, there wasn't really any way to test these ideas. After all, to make observations about the Earth's past,
you have to dig into the ground.
And very few geologists were lucky enough to spot canals or foundations of buildings being dug out, and those led to some really cool new discoveries.
All the early geologists were actually, almost all of them, were they were priests, pastors, you know, reverends. They were investigating the works of God, not the word of God. They believed in that too, but they were trying to mesh together the works of God and the word of God. And as they started going through geology and figuring out these layers of earth and strata and things like that, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and longer, and the past kept getting deeper.
But these examples were not easy to find.
And that's why geology really didn't get invented until we had a reason to dig into the ground, which was coal.
That brings us to England in the late 1700s and early 1800s, the Industrial Revolution. With the invention of the steam engine, the coal mining industry was expanding rapidly.
When we discovered coal and realized there was money in the ground and power because you could fuel your industries with it and your railroads and your war machines, that's when we started digging in the ground. That's when we started finding this stuff. And coal miners knew if they found a fossil and dug it out, all the professors at Oxford around there, because there were a lot of coal mines around Oxford, they would buy those money, right? Now, they didn't know what they were digging out. They didn't understand why these guys were obsessed with these fossils, but they knew it was money.
The quote-unquote scientists of the Bible gave us a foundation to start thinking about the Earth's past. And the drive for coal gave us the financial motivation to dig into the Earth, which led to the growth of geology. It was actually one of the pioneers of geology that inspired Ian to write his book.
I actually started writing about a guy who owned a pet hyena. And he actually wanted the pet hyena to watch it poo, because he was trying to prove a point about this one cave that had hyena poo in it. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating. Go into it a little bit in the book. And in this whole list I was reading about him was, and he announced the discovery of the first dinosaur, Megalosaurus.
This was a man named William Buckland.
So I was reading him, and he was a really interesting, really eccentric guy. He had a pet bear who he took to grad school parties. He would dress in a grad school cape and a cap and give him wine to drink at the party. There was a fountain at he was at University of Oxford. And to let his children play in the fountain, he would give them the dead bodies of crocodiles, and they would use those as rafts to paddle around the fountain. He was the very first professor of geology at Oxford.
Odd. Very odd. But he wasn't just a professor. He was a theologian and scientist. In the tradition of James Usher, Buckland was driven to find evidence of biblical truth, like the story of Noah's Ark.
I found him fascinating because the unwritten history of science is the history of scientists who spend their whole life investigating a mistake. William Buckland was actually his whole life researching proof of Noah's flood, the diluvial theory. And so that's why he was obsessed with geology and all that, because he thought he could prove through the geology the idea of Noah's flood. And as he went, the older and older Earth got, the more he investigated it. And he kept moving the idea of the flood further and further back.
Although he never found proof of the biblical flood, his investigations into the Earth would uncover quite a lot more. With help from a colleague who actually lived just a few miles from where he'd grown up, a colleague named Mary Anning. You might remember her from the beginning of this episode. Yes, from the small seaside town of Lyme Regis.
So Mary Anning was like all of the early sort of Victorian era geologists. She was a fascinating and obsessive and slightly odd person. She had an unbelievably tragic life. She was poor. She was not a member of the Church of England, her and her family, so they were sort of outcast anyways. So she was born as poor as you can possibly be. in Lyme Regis, which is in the south of England. It's a sea town, and it's on a place that's now designated as the Jurassic Coast. Because if you look up pictures of the Jurassic Coast online, it's these amazing dramatic cliff sides. And all of those cliffs are just stacked layers of ancient seas. People would come to escape the smog of Industrial Revolution London and surrounding cities, and they would come to the seaside town to get some fresh air. And so Mary Anning, her father taught her and her brother how to dig these little fossils out of the cliffside and to sell them as trinkets for, you know, a few pence at a time. And she had no formal education whatsoever, but she sort of started educating herself as she went. She would climb down cliffs, and she would dash across high tide waves just to get to the place that she was going to. She had a small dog that died in a landslide, because when you're on sort of precarious cliff sides like this, rockfall was always happening. So she had a tough job, and she just, a little bit at a time, she would dig out thousands and thousands of fossils.
While Mary Anning was scaling cliffs and prying fossils from rock shelves, William Buckland was becoming Oxford's first professor of geology. And during his visits back home, he'd stop down the road to see the shores of Lyme Regis and the fossils that were turning up there. And it was during that time that he connected with Mary Anning over the many, many bones that she kept digging up.
He came back and he found this woman who actually knew more about the coastline than he did, and he used to go walking with his father on these beaches every single day when he was a kid. So he started working with her, which at the time was extremely bizarre. Not only was it a man treating a woman as an equal, but he wasn't upper class. His father was a minister, so he was not wealthy, but he was educated. And so an educated person working with a lay person was just kind of shocking at the time. But William Buckland he's just a great guy. Like, the only thing he cared about was fossils and geology, right? And she knew a lot about it. And he educated her, and she educated him in turn. She was digging these things up. She was good at this stuff. And it's not just that she was good at finding them, but the actual physical work of uncovering them. She didn't even have good tools. She literally had a trowel. Her father was a carpenter, so she had some of his carpentry tools that he used. There are notes where she said, like, the physical labor of excavating would completely blind her, and she would have to stop. She would work until her eyes swelled shut. And she was working in this damp basement that was built right on the ocean, and so occasionally it would flood when the seas would come up high. She had the hardest life you can imagine, and not in a romantic way. And she had this ironic thing of, she educated herself to the point where she was more educated about this stuff than anyone around her, so she was considered an outsider. But she knew how important the work she was doing was to science, because she had gotten to that level, but she also knew she would never be part of it. So she was born an outsider, and she stayed an outsider, and she educated herself to the point where she realized that she was always on the outside looking in.
And yet, she still continued to excavate.
She was a businesswoman. She uncovered a plesiosaur. It's hanging in the Natural History Museum in London today. I think it's 14 feet long. It's amazing. And no one had ever seen anything like it. And so she sent illustrations that she made to some of the various characters that are in my book. And there are her notes underneath where she's negotiating with them. She said, well, I've got this person interested in buying it and this person interested in buying it. How much more can you give me? So she was not romantic about it, right? Yeah. She was working for a living.
A lot of discoveries were made because of the simple fact that folks needed to make a living. Like with the rise of coal mining, scientific discoveries of the time were a product of the social, political, and economic environment. But remember, society didn't just influence scientists in England. While the Industrial Revolution was picking up steam in England, in France, revolution was brewing. So here we are in France, near the end of the 1700s. Social unrest is at a breaking point. People riot, storm the Bastille, drive out the bourgeois, and of course, who can forget? The king's head gets chopped off. But what does this have to do with dinosaurs? Well, a lot according to Yen. Before the French Revolution, nobody dared to question the authority of the scriptures regarding the Earth's past. They didn't even know if the Earth was old enough for whole species to come and go. The idea of extinction didn't exist. But seeing the king beheaded in front of their eyes changed people's perspectives.
And before then, there couldn't be extinct animals because God created animals and God would not let something go extinct. Because it was philosophical, yeah. Right? The idea that this God king, God could have his head cut off and he could die. Well, France, there's a reason this idea came from France and not from Germany or England, where they had the same fossil records and the same bright people examining them. But there's a reason that France came up with this idea. And also the physical aspect of once the king got his head chopped off, his collection of fossils was opened up to the public. It became the France National Museum of History, which you can go visit today. It was the king's personal private collection of fossils. And suddenly it was just loosed on the world.
And luckily, there was a particularly smart person working at the museum. George Cuvier.
And this guy, Cuvier, was the assistant working there. He witnessed and was researching the greatest fossil collection in the history of the world, right? There were more fossils there and that were coming in constantly from all over France because all these aristocrats were getting their chateaus raided and these people didn't know what to do with these fossils, so they sent them to him. He was the recipient of more information than anyone had ever received at any point in time of fossils. And it also happened that he was a genius, so he was able to mesh all that information together.
There were a couple of really great ideas that he developed from all of this. The first was extinction.
Revolutions of the globe, he called it, mm-hmm. which I found fascinating because he was a product of a revolution.
And his second big idea was called the correlation of parts.
He had this idea of the correlation of parts, which is from one small bone, you can identify the entire rest of the animal. He was one of the inspirations for Sherlock Holmes, right? From one small clue, you can figure out the whole murder scene. And that's what Cuvier did, and a lot of it was based around the idea of teeth, right? What kind of tooth is it? Is it a molar? A molar means an herbivore, right? Mm-hmm. Unless it's a carnivore and it's a back molar, in which case you can figure that out. If it's an herbivore, that probably means it had hooves and horns, because all hooved and horned animals are herbivores, right? And you can figure out so much from one small thing. How worn is the tooth? That means how old it is. What kind of stuff it was eating, that sort of thing. The idea of taking a bone and studying it from every angle and kind of broad thinking beyond that bit of data and picturing the world that's broadcast out from that data became a really interesting idea. And that's what really broke open geology and paleontology and everything around it.
Cuvier's work was the vital missing link, pun intended, that reconstructed from these isolated bones and incomplete fossils whole animals and the worlds around them. And in fact, William Buckland's first encounter with a Megalosaurus fossil was almost 3 decades before its announcement to the world. It was in the collection of his anatomy professor at Oxford. But when he saw it, he had no idea at the time that it was the remnants of this giant land-roaming reptile. In those 3 decades, Mary Anning had relentlessly chipped away at rocks to reveal a remarkable number of bones, and proving beyond doubt that these were creatures unlike any other around us today. Plesiosaurus, Ichthyosaurus, and so on. These were technically not dinosaurs, but other giant prehistoric creatures. Slowly, these ideas began to take hold. Thanks to the local quarrymen, more Megalosaurus bones were found. And then came Cuvier. A meeting of minds, Buckland and Cuvier. Cuvier wielded his anatomical expertise like a magic wand to turn Buckland's collection of scattered bones to an entire prehistoric animal, Megalosaurus, the first dinosaur. So now to tell the world, and in the early 1800s, the most important people in the world of Western science were members of a very small group, the Royal Society.
The motto of the Royal Society, the oldest continuous scientific society in the world, in London, their motto essentially is, don't take anyone's word for it, right? And for one, I love that because it's very punk, like don't believe anyone, prove it yourself. Don't take your science teacher's word for it. Let them show you how we came to this idea and then work it out yourself. So in 1824, Megalosaurus was announced to the Royal Society, right? There's this thing. They didn't know it was a dinosaur at that point. That wasn't until later. But there's this giant reptile, 9 feet tall, quite a bit long, and it used to walk around the Earth. Great. There were 30 people in the room. And that their proof, a few bones, a few fossils, you know, ideas of how they fit together, you can't show that to the public and say, look, there's this thing. So the idea did not get out there until much, much, much later, until the 1850s. And that's when the Crystal Palace exhibition happened, which was essentially the world's first World's Fair. It was a celebration of Victorian England in all of its pomp and circumstance. And this if you look it up, is this amazing glass building that was built, and it had the world's first flushing toilet. It had an early form of computer that operated on leeches. Victorian-era London is just a nonstop delight. It was this amazing hit. They estimate something like a fifth of every citizen of England went to see it. And it was so successful, they tore it down, because it was only supposed to be up for about 6 months, and then they rebuilt it in Crystal Palace Park in the south of London. And when they rebuilt it, they had more room. And how are we going to celebrate the great achievements of England when one of the great achievements of England was geology, right? Because almost all that work really did happen in England. And so they built the world's first theme park, which was, it's called Dinosaur Island. I went to visit it. You can volunteer and go help weed Dinosaur Island. I've done it. It's great. Did it with my kids. They thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And on that island is the world's first, they built a model of dinosaurs, right? Megalosaurus and Ichthyosaurus and Plesiosaurus and Iguanodon and Megalodon, a few others. And and so that was the first time the public was actually introduced to the idea of dinosaurs. And it was a huge hit, right? I mean, immediately, the first mention in print, in fiction of a dinosaur is in Bleak House by Charles Dickens. Like, people immediately picked it up because illustrators in newspapers thought it was, you know, it's visual, it's dinosaurs, they're great. And immediately it became popular. And so for the opening of this exhibition, Waterhouse Hawkins, who was the sculptor who designed these, he built little mini figurines to sell. I mean, this is a tourist attraction, right? And so these little figurines, people would come, they would see it, and they were scattered all over England. So that was where the idea of dinosaurs came from. You know, why do we know what dinosaurs are? You can show any kid a dinosaur and they'll know what it is. It came from that park. It didn't come from William Buckland talking to 30 people in the Royal Society about fossils. It came from Crystal Palace Park in the south of London.
And thus, dinosaurs entered into public consciousness. And boy, were they here to stay. So what's the deal with dinos today? We asked Ian.
Yeah, I mean, they're all around you. They're chirping in the trees. You know, birds are dinosaurs. So I talked to this really interesting professor of the philosophy of science, which I did not know was a thing until I started doing this book, but it's fascinating. And so basically he was saying, if you think Stegosaurus is a dinosaur and you think Tyrannosaurus rex is a dinosaur, it turns out the only thing they have in common is a hole in their hip socket. It's one of the defining trait of dinosaurs. Well, it turns out every bird you see around you has a hole in their hip socket. So birds are dinosaurs. I mean, they survived the extinction event, which is just fascinating to read about the more you get into that. But yeah, so they survived, but the rest of them got wiped out. It's probably a good thing for us. There's this phrase like new technology equals new perceptions, right? Every advance we have in technology gets applied in every aspect of science, biology and astronomy and geology and paleontology. And so now with CAT scans and 3D imagery and things like that, they are able to look, slice and dice the data and the information. And the data for this is just fossil bones, right? Slice and dice that information in new and different ways. They don't think that Tyrannosaurus Rex roared like it does in the Jurassic Park movies, right? They really don't know if there were vocal cords that were capable of doing that. They probably made some kind of sound, but it's not sexy, let's put it that way. The answer is not sexy. Yes, they roared. Yes, they tweeted like birds, or no, they were totally mute. The answer is, oh, but they probably made some kind of grunty noise. Yeah, sorry, people.
Such a disappointment. As much as we love the idea of this big old roaring lizard, that's probably not quite accurate. But as we get better tools to study dinosaurs, we'll keep learning more and more and keep filling in these gaps in the story.
All humans work in stories. Right. But that's what scientists actually do, right? It's like you're not studying a data point. You're studying that data point because you're trying to prove a larger theory. I mean, the scientific method is a story, right? You start with a question, you're trying to answer that question, and the answer is the story, right? So I think science communication is couching data in stories.
Everyone loves a good story, don't they? It's something we as scientists also have to do. Tell stories about our science to ourselves, our peers, our friends, and families. Stories based on evidence, but stories nonetheless. And dinosaurs are a great story. But think about all the beliefs and doubts that had to be shattered by these pioneers to arrive at their existence. Think of the churnings in society and the immense hard work of individuals that made it possible. Even today, we are constantly making new discoveries that will challenge our beliefs and intuitions about the world. As society changes and as scientists dig up new evidence every day, who knows what new stories are just around the corner, waiting to be told. This episode was written and produced by Ben Mansky, Nancy Kai, and myself, Arjo Ray, with editing help from the rest of the team here at Carry the One Radio. Jan Lendler's book is called The First Dinosaur: How Science Solved the Greatest Mystery on Earth, and is available online wherever books are sold. If you like what you heard, please share, subscribe, and tell a friend. And do check out carrytheoneradio.com for more information and for more than 100 of our previous episodes. And last but not the least, we are grateful to our science producers, Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orstel, Janine Cuevas, Judith Horn, and David Cabral for supporting us. And you can do so as well by donating to the show at patreon.com/carrytheone. Till next time, goodbye, stay well, and stay curious.
If you had the power, would you bring back dinosaurs?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. No, they're talking about bringing, but you know, they've got the DNA of mastodons and mammoths, yeah, and wondering whether they can try to bring them back. But yeah, it'd be awesome.
Yeah. I guess some of that's more recent. So
I want to see a velociraptor, don't you? Right?
From distance, yes. Right. Definitely. Yeah.
If movies tell me anything, it's that everything will work out fine.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, every movie
will totally work out fine.